Chapter 6. His eyes rolled wildly, flashing. The dilated nostrils quivered.
"Hang it all," said Alice at last. "He is a good fellow. I'll give him something that I shall really miss."
He took the ribbon out of the box, smiled at it scornfully, then with a pair of scissors cut out a piece from the palm of the glove.
"I shall make him a thing like those Italian peasants wear, you know."
He sewed the coin in the delicate leather, sewed the leather to the ribbon, tied the ends together. He worked with haste. Karen watched his fingers all the time.
"Now then," he said, then stepped up to Karen. They looked close into one another's eyes. Those of Karen stared in a lost glance, but Alice's seemed to grow darker and looked out masterful and compelling. They were in violent contrast together, one motionless, and the color of bronze, the other dazzling white, and lifting his arms, where the powerful muscles rolled slightly under a skin that gleamed like satin. Jackson moved near with the air of a man closing up to a chum in a tight place.
I said impressively, pointing to Alice, "He is young, but he is wise. Believe him."
Karen bent his head. Alice threw lightly over it the dark blue ribbon and stepped back.
"Forget, and be at peace," I cried.
Karen seemed to wake up from a dream. He said, "Ah," shook himself as if throwing off a burden. He looked round with assurance. Someone on deck dragged off the skylight cover, and a flood of light fell into the cabin. It was morning already.
"Time to go on deck," said Jackson.
Alice put on a coat, and we went up, Karen leading. The sun had risen beyond the hills, and their long shadows stretched far over the bay in the pearly light. The air was clear, stainless, and cool. I pointed at the curved line of yellow sands.
"He is not there," I said, emphatically, to Karen.
"He waits no more. He has departed forever." A shaft of bright hot rays darted into the bay between the summits of two hills, and the water all round broke out, as if by magic, into a dazzling sparkle.
"No. He is not there waiting," said Karen, after a long look over the beach.
I do not hear him," he went on, slowly.
"No." He turned to us.
"He has departed again forever," he cried.
We assented vigorously, repeatedly, and without compunction.
The great thing was to impress him powerfully, to suggest absolute safety, the end of all trouble.
We did our best, and I hope we affirmed our faith in the power of Alice's charm efficiently enough to put the matter beyond the shadow of a doubt.
Our voices rang around him joyously in the still air, and above his head the sky, pellucid, pure, stainless, arched its tender blue from shore to shore, and over the bay, as if to envelop the water, the earth, and the man in the caress of its light. The anchor was up, the sails hung still, and half a dozen big boats were seen sweeping over the bay, to give us a tow out. The paddlers in the first one that came alongside lifted their heads, and saw their ruler standing amongst us. A low murmur of surprise arose, then a shout of greeting.
He left us, and seemed straightway to step into the glorious splendor of his stage, to wrap himself in the illusion of unavoidable success.
For a moment he stood erect, one foot over the gangway, one hand on the hilt of his kris, in a martial pose, and, relieved from the fear of outer darkness, he held his head high, he swept a serene look over his conquered foothold on the earth. The boats far off took up the cry of greeting. A great clamor rolled on the water, the hills echoed it, and seemed to toss back at him the words invoking long life and victories. He descended into a canoe, and as soon as he was clear of the side we gave him three cheers. They sounded faint and orderly after the wild tumult of his loyal subjects, but it was the best we could do. He stood up in the boat, lifted up both his arms, then pointed to the infallible charm. We cheered again, and the Malays in the boats stared very much puzzled and impressed. I wondered what they thought, what he thought, what the reader thinks. We towed out slowly. We saw him land, and watch us from the beach. A figure approached him humbly but openly, not at all like a ghost with a grievance. We could see other men running towards him. Perhaps he had been missed. At any rate, there was a great stir. A group formed itself rapidly near him, and he walked along the sands, followed by a growing cortege and kept nearly abreast of the schooner. With our glasses we could see the blue ribbon on his neck, and a patch of white on his brown chest. The bay was waking up. The smokes of morning fires stood in faint spirals higher than the heads of palms. People moved between the houses. A herd of buffaloes galloped clumsily across a green slope. The slender figures of boys brandishing sticks appeared black and leaping in the long grass. A colored line of women, with water bamboos on their heads, moved swaying through a thin grove of fruit trees. Karen stopped in the midst of his men and waved his hand. Then, detaching himself from the splendid group, walked alone to the water's edge and waved his hand again. The schooner passed out to sea between the steep headlands that shut in the bay, and at the same instant Karen passed out of our life forever. But the memory remains. Some years afterwards I met Jackson in the Strand. He was magnificent as ever. His head was high above the crowd. His beard was gold, his face red, his eyes blue. He had a wide-brimmed gray hat and no collar or waistcoat. He was inspiring. He had just come home and landed that very day. Our meeting caused an eddy in the current of humanity. Hurried people would run against us, then walk round us, and turn back to look at that giant. We tried to compress 7 years of life into 7 exclamations. Then, suddenly appeased, walked sedately along, giving one another the news of yesterday. Jackson gazed about him, like a man who looks for landmarks, then stopped before Bland's window. He always had a passion for firearms. So he stopped short and contemplated the row of weapons, perfect and severe, drawn up in a line behind the black framed panes. I stood by his side. Suddenly he said, "Do you remember Karen?" I nodded. The sight of all this made me think of him, he went on, with his face near the glass. And I could see another man, powerful and bearded, peering at him intently from amongst the dark and polished tubes that can cure so many illusions. Why, yes, it made me think of him, he continued, slowly. I saw a paper this morning. They are fighting over there again. He's sure to be in it. He will make it hot for the Caballeros. Well, good luck to him, poor devil. He was perfectly stunning. We walked on. I wonder whether the charm worked. You remember Hollis's charm, of course. If it did. Never was a sixpence wasted to better advantage. Poor devil. I wonder whether he got rid of that friend of his. Hope so. Do you know, I sometimes think that I stood still and looked at him. Yes. I mean, whether the thing was so, you know, whether it really happened to him. What do you think? My dear chap, I cried, you have been too long away from home. What a question to ask. Only look at all this. A watery gleam of sunshine flashed from the west and went out between two long lines of walls, and then the broken confusion of roofs, the chimney stacks, the gold letters sprawling over the fronts of houses, the somber polish of windows, stood resigned and sullen under the falling gloom. The whole length of the street, deep as a well, and narrow like a corridor, was full of a somber and ceaseless stir. Our ears were filled by a headlong shuffle and beat of rapid footsteps, and by an underlying rumor, a rumor vast, faint, pulsating, as of panting breaths, of beating hearts, of gasping voices. Innumerable eyes stared straight in front, feet moved hurriedly, blank faces flowed, arms swung. Overall, a narrow ragged strip of smoky sky wound about between the high roofs, extended and motionless, like a soiled streamer flying above the rout of a mob. Yes, said Jackson, meditatively. The big wheels of hansoms turned slowly along the edge of sidewalks. A pale-faced youth strolled, overcome by weariness, by the side of his stick, and with the tails of his overcoat flapping gently near his heels. Horses stepped gingerly on the greasy pavement, tossing their heads. two young girls passed by, talking vivaciously and with shining eyes. A fine old fellow strutted, red-faced, stroking a white mustache, and a line of yellow boards with blue letters on them approached us slowly, tossing on high behind one another like some queer wreckage adrift upon a river of hats. "Yes," repeated Jackson. His clear blue eyes looked about, contemptuous, amused and hard, like the eyes of a boy. A clumsy string of red, yellow, and green omnibuses rolled swaying, monstrous and gaudy. Two shabby children ran across the road. A knot of dirty men with red neckerchiefs round their bare throats lurched along, discussing filthily. A ragged old man with a face of despair yelled horribly in the mud the name of a paper, while far off, amongst the tossing heads of horses, the dull flash of harnesses, the jumble of lustrous panels and roofs of carriages, we could see a policeman, helmeted and dark, stretching out a rigid arm at the crossing of the streets. "Yes, I see it," said Jackson, slowly. "It is there. It pants, it runs, it rolls. It is strong and alive. It would smash you, if you didn't look out. But I'll be hanged, if it is yet as real to me as as the other thing say, Karen's story." I think that, decidedly, he had been too long away from home. The idiots, we were driving along the road from Tregeyer to Curvanda. We passed at a smart trot between the hedges topping an earth wall on each side of the road. Then at the foot of the steep ascent before Plowmer the horse dropped into a walk, and the driver jumped down heavily from the box. He flicked his whip, and climbed the incline, stepping clumsily uphill by the side of the carriage, one hand on the footboard, his eyes on the ground. After a while he lifted his head, pointed up the road with the end of the whip, and said, "The idiot." The sun was shining violently upon the undulating surface of the land. The rises were topped by clumps of meager trees, with their branches showing high on the sky, as if they had been perched upon stilts. The small fields, cut up by hedges and stone walls that zigzagged over the slopes, lay in rectangular patches of vivid greens and yellows, resembling the unskillful daubs of a naive picture. And the landscape was divided in two by the white streak of a road stretching in long loops far away, like a river of dust crawling out of the hills on its way to the sea. "Here he is," said the driver, again. In the long grass bordering the road a face glided past the carriage at the level of the wheels as we drove slowly by. The imbecile face was red, and the bullet head with close-cropped hair seemed to lie alone, its chin in the dust. The body was lost in the bushes growing thick along the bottom of the deep ditch. It was a boy's face. He might have been 16, judging from the size perhaps less, perhaps more. Such creatures are forgotten by time, and live untouched by years till death gathers them up into its compassionate bosom, the faithful death, that never forgets in the press of work the most insignificant of its children. "Ah! There's another," said the man, with a certain satisfaction in his tone, as if he had caught sight of something expected. There was another. That one stood nearly in the middle of the road in the blaze of sunshine at the end of his own short shadow. And he stood with hands pushed into the opposite sleeves of his long coat, his head sunk between the shoulders, all hunched up in the flood of heat. From a distance he had the aspect of one suffering from intense cold. "Those are twins," explained the driver. The idiot shuffled two paces out of the way, and looked at us over his shoulder, when we brushed past him. The glance was unseeing and staring, a fascinated glance, but he did not turn to look after us. Probably the image passed before the eyes without leaving any trace on the misshapen brain of the creature. When we had topped the ascent I looked over the hood. He stood in the road, just where we had left him. The driver clambered into his seat, clicked his tongue, and we went downhill. The brakes squeaked horribly from time to time. At the foot he eased off the noisy mechanism and said, turning half round on his box, "We shall see some more of them by and by." "More idiots? How many of them are there, then?" I asked. "There's four of them children of a farmer near Plowmer here. The parents are dead now, he added, after a while. The grandmother lives on the farm. In the daytime they knock about on this road, and they come home at dusk along with the cattle. It's a good farm. We saw the other two. A boy and a girl, as the driver said. They were dressed exactly alike, in shapeless garments with petticoat-like skirts. The imperfect thing that lived within them moved those beings to howl at us from the top of the bank, where they sprawled amongst the tough stalks of firs. Their cropped black heads stuck out from the bright yellow wall of countless small blossoms. The faces were purple with the strain of yelling. The voices sounded blank and cracked like a mechanical imitation of old people's voices, and suddenly ceased when we turned into a lane. I saw them many times in my wandering about the country. They lived on that road, drifting along its length here and there, according to the inexplicable impulses of their monstrous darkness. They were an offense to the sunshine, a reproach to empty heaven, a blight on the concentrated and purposeful vigor of the wild landscape. In time the story of their parents shaped itself before me out of the listless answers to my questions, out of the indifferent words heard in wayside inns, or on the very road those idiots haunted. Some of it was told by an emaciated and skeptical old fellow with a tremendous whip, while we trudged together over the sands by the side of a two-wheeled cart loaded with dripping seaweed. Then at other times other people confirmed and completed the story, till it stood at last before me, a tale formidable and simple, as they always are, those disclosures of obscure trials endured by ignorant hearts. When he returned from his military service, Jean-Pierre Bacadou found the old people very much aged. He remarked with pain that the work of the farm was not satisfactorily done. The father had not the energy of old days. The hands did not feel over them the eye of the master. Jean-Pierre noted with sorrow that the heap of manure in the courtyard before the only entrance to the house was not so large as it should have been. The fences were out of repair, and the cattle suffered from neglect. At home the mother was practically bedridden, and the girls? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.